Once you find out about death, your life inevitably changes forever. I've traumatized a preschooler by accident when I used to teach, and I helped them discover death happened. And it was very upsetting for both of us because I didn't want to do that. Because I told them about presidents, they're like, where are they now? And I'm like,
not here.
I am villager number one.
Be not afraid. I am an angel come to give you rebirth and a thirst for blood, which is what Jesus would want, I'm guessing. And we're Googles next door.
Great intro.
Thanks.
Talking about spooky stuff.
Yeah, we're talking about spooky stuff. I like religion. And fanaticism and the question of what happens when we die. Do we want to do that?
Yeah.
Is it a good or bad thing? Do the actions we make here affect where we go next? What's God doing?
If you never got consequences in your regular life, do they come in the afterlife? Bev.
Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah, and some spooky stuff. So we're continuing our Flanagan series with his show Midnight Mass, which I will explain in my section, is essentially his first. It's like the first idea. It's the one that he had really close to his heart for a long time, and it took forever to make.
Yeah.
And then he finally got to do it, and it's a sleeper. I think people sleep on it.
Yeah, it was really beautiful, like, as a story, like, just emotionally complex and beautiful. And I feel like all of his stuff is that, but this one just, like, had a real sadness to it, but also, like, joy. Like, there's, like, a lot of just, like, real human expression of emotions that you got a little more happiness in parts, I think, than we saw in the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got the full picture of what it is to exist, I guess.
Yeah, he showed us like two sides of spirituality, right? There's like this scary sharpened knife, right? Version when it's in the wrong hands and when it, you know, belief is twisted and manipulated for control. And then he showed us like what spirituality could bring us as a way of like freedom or accepting ourselves and our flaws and understanding that we never stop growing and that we're everything and nothing all at once. And that's actually beautiful.
Yeah.
And so there's so many.
So beautiful.
Yeah. There's so many lines in this that I think hit me way more than any of his other shows so far. Like the situations and the characters in the other shows have been amazing. We've talked about it. But there's just... Yeah. Some lines here, and I'm feeling because, like, again, we kickstarted this series because I watched The Fall of House of Usher, which we're covering next week, and I was like, wow, he really hit it out of the park. This is amazing. This is his best work, because there was a whole scene and a line or not line but like a what's the word, I mean, like an actor's like a monologue of like the speech that was given, and I was like, snaps, I was like, that's it, that's true, that's everything. I was like, he's done it. And I said that to my friend at tell them to watch it, and they were like, are you sure? Are you sure this is it, this is the one? And I was like, no, you're right, hold up. Give me a minute, I'm gonna rewatch everything. And then I'll come back and I'll tell you what the rankings are. So next week maybe I'll be able to kind of have rankings
definitively.
But I will say, after rewatching this and knowing like what happens and going in with like media analysis glasses on, the lines hit me a lot more, and I will say has significantly trumped the monologue in Fall of the House of Usher. Like, I don't know, some of these, like, they like hit, and like some were really exciting and some were like, oh, that's so heavy and beautiful and painful and freeing all at once. So, but let me tell you about Midnight Mass, and you all tell me if this is what your interpretation of it was. I will say I'm coming from a place where I grew up in a religious setting, not Catholic, did not have the same, like, kudos to people who survive, like, Catholicism and, like, Catholic school and that upbringing, like, total different traumas than what I grew up with, but yeah. Definitely a religious background, like, something that was very innate in mm-hmm. overwhelming in my youth, and something that just, like, catered a lot. I think I've said it before on the show that there was a point in time in my life that I wanted to be a nun. I genuinely did. I loved Jesus. I thought he was wonderful. God, not so much. Old Testament God, he's a little scary. Yeah. I don't like him. could do without.
But Jesus's teachings, mostly really good, you know?
He's
good
guy. A nice guy.
Good dude.
He wanted to help people. He cared about them. He wanted to heal the sick and care for the outcasts. And he was rad. There's like a quote from a book by Barbara Kingsolver, the Poisonwood Bible. And it has this discussion of a person who says, like, you know, I always could, like, love Jesus. I could understand Jesus as this caring, like, you know, loving soul. And then I could also understand, like, a vengeful, like, awful God. But I can't picture them in the same place. I can't picture them as the same, like, religion, or like that they're in the same, like, I have to believe in both. It's like they can't both exist. Because one would have to stop the other. Like, it was just like, you can't both exist. And that's
what's like the duality humans are, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can do real harm, or you can do real good.
Yeah.
Or somewhere in the middle.
And it's really all how you handle yourself when you do both of those things, but also how we handle and react to other people when they do those things.
Like, yeah.
Giving people the same grace that we feel we're afforded and serve.
Yeah. And like the hand of the individual versus like the hand of the collective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The collective can be doing crazy things, totally independent of what the one person's doing. But the one person could be real rad and doing nice things. But it can't compare to the giant thing that's causing, you know, oceans to flood the whole world and kill everything. You know, stuff like that. It's just like, just, you know, little things, all like these things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, let me jump in. Let's do this. So, Midnight Mass is from 2021, and it's about an isolated island community experiences miraculous events and frightening omens after the arrival of a charismatic, mysterious young priest, and it's created by Mike Flanagan. And, I'll just leave it at that. With returning actors, if you have, like, again, if you slept on this, watch it. It's a slow burn. It does take a minute for you to get into it, but it is something where I feel like you really do need to watch. I might spoil what happens in a way, because it's kind of important. Well, like, because there's a big issue that's happening. So I do recommend it being like a watch that you do and not getting spoiled before seeing it. But I will say, knowing what happened and rewatching it, I caught a lot of things, and it spoke to me differently, because like the things that characters said had so much more weight, because I was like, oh, you say that because of this. Specifically with the new charismatic young priest, he be saying stuff.
It's like giving it away. One last thing, I promise. I'll also say, like, the first time I watched this, I was like, I'm bored, I don't want to do it, and I stopped. Like, literally, like, when it was popular, when everyone was talking about it, I remember it was like trending on Netflix, and I was like, I just don't feel like watching a whole hour for why. And then I rewatch it now, and I'm like, wow, I was so wrong. This is really good. Like, this is so emotional. So, like, if you tried to watch it before and it wasn't your thing, maybe give it another shot. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's my two cents.
I will say, when it starts to amp up, it's amping. And then it just goes. But it does take a minute to get there, so you do have to be patient. So Midnight Mass is a slow burn horror series exploring the impact of spirituality, our place in the universe, and the horrors that we face when religion is contorted and weaponized. Set on a remote island community called Crockett Island, the story follows the townspeople's small lives as they're greatly impacted by this arrival of the young enigmatic priest named Father Paul. We join the island at a time of returns and arrivals. We're first introduced to Riley Flynn, who is returning to the island after being released from prison after a tragic event that left a young woman dead and Riley forced to sober up. Also returned to the island is Riley's childhood best friend and possibly first love, Erin, who, now pregnant, lives in her deceased abusive mother's home and works her mother's job as a teacher in a tiny school. New Sheriff Hassan is finding his place in a community reluctant to acknowledge their own prejudices. And finally, with the arrival of Father Paul, which means the delayed return of the town's Monsignor Pruitt. So with the arrival of Paul means a delay of Pruitt. Who is there very old.
And in such a small town, it's rare for so many comings and goings.
Yeah, yeah. It's a super small community. And we learn that it used to be a little bigger, that it's small because they sold off the land for like oil money. Yep. And so a bunch of, so it's very, it's like, oh, like 100 or less people live in here.
Yeah.
So any little impact is felt throughout the whole community. So as Father Paul settles into the community, miraculous events start occurring, including healings and strange occurrences that suggest a divine presence. In one instance, a young woman who had been accidentally shot and was then no longer
paralyzed.
She was paralyzed. She was no longer able to walk. Miraculously can walk. What a miracle. We don't have to question those. The science is wrong.
Why question a good thing? It's working.
The big thing is like they don't question further because the healthcare system is so expensive and a scam that they're too poor to investigate further. So
yeah,
it's a little setup for some other stories he will explore. So the islanders, desperate for hope and meaning, embrace the miracles, leading to a revival of faith among them. At the start, there's only a few people in the church, and by the end of it, it's packed. It's like, ooh, look at you all of a sudden coming to church because we got miracles. However, we got miracles now? Well, I'll go.
As I went to church before, it was cool. That's what they said.
Yeah, they're like, that's why I got healed. Now they're like, I got a tummy ache. However, as the miracles escalate and people's deepest desires and secrets come to light, the true nature of Father Paul's presence and the source of the miracles becomes increasingly ominous. Like, so he is a very charismatic pastor, preacher. I don't know what the Catholic specific Catholic term is, Father Paul. He
I can tell you.
Is so what, like, he's very well spoken and he's soft spoken and kind. And to have a horror show that's based around religion being horror, and then you have this priest and he's not creepy, that he's just kind and soft and caring, and he demands honesty and alludes to giving honesty. I thought it was great. The internet and Gabe thought it was pretty hot. But not all of us, you know, watched Fleabag and were forever changed in season 2.
Yeah.
And the priest. That piece from Fleabag, you know, rewired a lot of our brains. And maybe now we read spicy books that just question our morals. It's fine. So as tensions rise and suspicions mount, the islanders find themselves facing a terrifying truth about the origins of Father Paul's powers and the sinister force that has infiltrated their community. It's too little too late. And ultimately, Midnight Mass builds to a gripping and emotionally resonant conclusion that challenges viewers to confront their own beliefs in the nature of good and evil. It is a thought-provoking and chilling exploration of the human condition and mysteries of faith and spirituality. In summation. So this I kind of alluded to it. Midnight Mass is a very personal story for Flanagan. So Midnight Mass has been a long time coming. The idea was a founding idea of Flanagan's, ever present in his works, that paved the way for him to create his incredibly personal show. So like all the while he was getting approved for all these shows, he was like, okay, but at some point we're going to do mine, right? Like this, we're going to do this other one, right? Yeah. The beginning scene actually of the show, which is the police blue red lights flashing on the Christ fish that's on a, is like a bumper thingy on a car. It's flashing on that, which is a car accident. That scene is actually referenced in Flanagan's film Hush, when the protagonist's computer is shown, and it's the first lines of her novel. And it describes that. Because at first, he did want it to be a novel. He just always wanted, he knew it had to be something. So as he began creating his other amazing series, he held strong to the script for Midnight Mass. And while filming Bly Manor, Flanagan was out location scouting for his other show, Midnight Mass, eventually building the town of Crockett. Because he couldn't find one that was like old and sad. Enough. All the towns were doing fine. Flanagan actually grew up as an altar boy and his life very much tied to the church until he went to college, where he was first introduced to other concepts of religion. And he dove into those other ideologies, trying to find one that fit. He said for a while, he was like, Buddhism really spoke to him. There's just like a few that he resonated with, but he didn't know there was options. That you could have other ones. And he also had where there was like an older, like seasoned priest, and then later a younger priest that was like totally different, you know, threw everyone off. So all the while, him with these ideologies and in writing the script, and he was struggling with alcoholism and recovery. And so the show is an expression of this journey, and it took on a new form as the time went on and his relationship with sobriety changed to something firm. Like, I don't know what that story would have been, but it's different. And to the point where he has said, it's a very different show with 3 years of sobriety behind me than it would have been before that. I feel that it would have been an incomplete conversation. He said this in an interview. Those conversations were so inseparable in my head that this show was always where they were, just kind of dumped. It's where they lived as a record of my perspective of sobriety through various points in my life, in the full grips of it, in the denial of it, and the acceptance of it. And it's just very honest in that way. And you can see that. He puts himself into his work. And that's, I think, where it shines. So I think one of the biggest themes of this show is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? And as someone who grew up in the church, I resonated heavy with this show. I expected a horror show where a religious town is monstrified by its devotion to faith to, in the end, vilify religion. I really thought I was going to do that. I was pleasantly surprised that's not the case. And so I have a very religious friend who was like, should I watch this? And I was like, no, you good. And I've read, I read a review by a member of a church who was like, this is a great film and it or show, and it should teach you things about your religion and how you should be operating in the world. And I was like, yeah. So it doesn't. But I expected it to do that, to criticize and scrutinize religious practice and warn others against organized religion. But I didn't find that in the conclusion of Midnight Mass, not exactly. What I found instead was understanding, a true understanding of the impact of religion, belief, guilt, shame, and the innate need for acceptance and forgiveness that draws people to religion in the first place. There's a conversation in the film, again, of which there are many that stick with me, where the real villain of the story, Bev, a religious, hateful monster of a woman, is confronted by Sheriff Hassan, played by Raul, who was in Bly Manor.
I said I love him.
Yes. Me too. Tyga has a lot of hotties in the show. Mm-hmm. A lot of hotties. Okay. But she's confronted by new Sheriff Hassan, who found fault with his young Muslim son being given a Bible in school, in public school. This is mm-hmm. insane. So during this exchange, where he's like, you would all be in an uproar if your kids came home with a Quran. Like, there's no, like, in what world? It's just because it's your, anyway. During yeah. this exchange, she makes horrid remarks about Hassan's culture and the Quran, which he respectfully addresses and redirects to her. He held it very well. Happy coming over that desk. This whole scene is brilliant, showing the ignorance Americans have about the Quran, an ignorance that I myself had at a young age when I was also religious. We weren't allowed to learn about the other options. Honestly, mm-hmm. bless public school, because I learned about Hinduism, and that's what changed. That's when I changed, because I was like, that's cool. I was like, we got stories too. We got make-believe as well, but your make-believe is so much cooler than our make-believe. And I was like, okay, who said that mine's right? I had this whole, like, it was a whole moment for me.
Yeah.
So growing up, I, you know, had the same ignorance, especially being someone who was young when, like, 9/11 happens. Like, I didn't even know the world was different, you know? Mm-hmm. But I have this strong memory of being introduced to and taught about the Quran by a close family friend who told me how it was very much like the Bible that I had been raised to believe in. No more violence or less forgiving. It's really about mm-hmm. the fact that it's a tool, and it depends on whose hands it's in. Yep. Just like Christianity. It's the same thing. So she follows this up. In the scene, Bev makes a dig at Hassan in the Quran, mentioning its profound violence. And she follows this up by saying she would never preach about Lot in school, missing the entire point that no part of the Bible should be taught in public schools because of its violence. She's like, we don't teach the violent parts, because he's like, there's violence in the Quran. There's violence in the Bible. The Bible is scary. Yeah. And that's like the point that really struck me, because both of these texts are quite violent. A lot of religious ones are. And I grew up hearing Bible stories, including the horrifying Lot, as bedtime stories. And I now understand that they shouldn't be stories that you're telling children, especially not as bedtime stories. They're scary stories they shouldn't know. And Flanagan understands the brutality of the Bible and how it can blend so fluidly into the horror genre. It's honestly perfect the way he did it. But he says, when I was a kid and in Bible study, the horror elements embedded in the Bible are impossible to ignore. You've got angels patrolling through Egypt and slaughtering the firstborn. You've got the river turning to blood. You've got plagues of locusts and a pillar of fire. And you've got a God who's thrilled to just murder people at will and full of wrath. You've got demons. You've got talking serpents. And you've got people being torn apart, torture, and it's all there. So, talk about horror. Just like read the Bible. The Bible can be a horrific thing already, but these already cultish practices are further twisted into maliciousness with the introduction of an angel, which is the vampire. Which I totally get. There was it's long lost to me, the source, but I remember there was like a lore that vampires are the mark of Cain. So Cain did the first murder, and there's a quote unquote mark. Mm. He's marked for that murder. And they said the mm-hmm. mark was that he became a vampire. It was his punishment. And I was like, I believe that. That sounds cool. It sounds like something rad the Bible would do. There's also, we've talked about kind of angel, demon, vampire lore in our vampire episode, when we talked about Lilith, or Kat talked about Lilith, who is the first woman mm-hmm. who became a demon/vampire, maybe. So concurrent to these horrors is forgiveness and the comfort that comes from the eternal, unconditional love that Christ is supposed to offer. Right. And ultimately, Midnight Mass is a very human story blended heavily with supernatural elements. Each of the people on this island felt real. And in discussing our plan for this episode, yeah. Kat, who does not know the Christian or Catholic religion, reasonably asked how this group of people could be so ignorant of the fact that they were bringing about the apocalypse. And this question is why I appreciated the show so greatly, because I think sometimes people don't realize how easy it is to be led astray when you mean well. And you're right, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. So Father Paul, who's later revealed, so here's spoilers. Father Paul, later revealed to be a rejuvenated, reborn Monsignor Pruitt, truly believed he was doing the right thing. So he was at this very vulnerable point. You know, he had dementia. He was old. He had lived his life and it had some regrets. And he was like in the promised land. And then he's faced with this monster and he's reborn in this horrific way. How else would your brain that's like that reinterpret that? And so for me, he was never a villain in my eyes. Like not to excuse, he's bad. He did bad things, but he wasn't like, I think he becomes corrupt and unhinged, but I always felt that he had the best intentions. Like he wasn't doing it to hurt people. He thought he was saving people. And also he's a person.
Yeah.
So,
it's almost like impact matters more than intentions.
Yeah. Yeah. Like he's not evil like Beth.
Here.
He's not evil, but he was a bad guy. Okay. Not discarding that. So an interview with the actor Hamish Linklater, who plays Father Paul, spoke on this role and the desire to portray a good-natured, well-meaning person confronting some dark truths, that we as viewers had to trust him as much as the townspeople did. And he said, how do you take somebody who you think is a rational person or a person of faith or a person that you think is a little like you and walk them into this place where they would willingly kill themselves for an idea? And he continued in that interview saying, one of my first conversations with Mike was, I'm playing a priest in this genre. I just want to make sure you don't want me to be skewed or sinister or scary or anything like that. The guy's trying to do the right thing all the way through it, as far as his understanding of what the right thing is. Because I felt that Monsignor truly cared for his people, and after experiencing what he did in that moment of true vulnerability, with the baggage of a lifetime of religion and regret, that he thought something profound and biblical had happened to him, and that he'd been shown the light in a way to help his people. But he was also just a man. He really was just a guy.
Yeah.
And so he was swayed by his own interests and desires. I'm sure there was the temptation of power in there. And if the Bible is to be believed, then I think that's precisely how it would happen. Right? We wouldn't know we were bringing on the apocalypse. We wouldn't know to stop it because we were the ones bringing it. Right? I think if the Bible is real and the apocalypse is supposed to happen, that we do it to ourselves thinking we are doing something good. Because I believe people would... Most people try to be good. There are plenty of people who aren't being good. But I genuinely, general populace do try to be good. No one's genuinely trying to hurt people all the time. So the apocalypse won't look like a big bad evil because then we'd stop it, right? Or we'd at least try.
I'd fight against it,
Or you'd like hope that that's the case, right?
Put in some effort. Yeah, exactly.
Kind of trying to do it now. Big bad evil happening. I don't think it's the apocalypse, but it certainly feels like that for a lot of people. And so we try to stop it, right? But if the, like, if we're going on Bible is real, apocalypse is going to happen, revelations, it has to happen. Like, it's supposed to happen. Just like Jesus had to die in the horrific way that he did. There wasn't, he was like, do I got a dad? Are you sure this is it? And dad's like, get over it. Go into the desert for 40 days. Think about it. Come back and do it. Okay. Someone will betray you. We don't really, it's fine. We want them to. So what better way to ensure it happens?
The Matrix. I'm sorry.
What better way to ensure that it happens than to make it look like a good thing? This is all me preaching as a former religious child.
Wow, it makes sense. It makes sense that that's how people would do it. Because as you said, like they just... I remember watching Supernatural and like being like, yeah, demons, I guess, would be trying to corrupt people. Sure. But like, I didn't think it would go down how it did in the show, where it was like, you got to fight the big bad. And I totally agree that we're all like humans in general are pretty impressionable, and we would think we're doing the right thing. We'd be trying to help. It's like the one I quoted her before, but she said, like, people are kind, but without, like, discernment.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to, like, quote it retroactively, but, like, it's a whole thing where, like, people want to be kind, but sometimes they aren't using their critical thinking skills or common sense or whatever is common. I don't know. But, like, you know, like, discernment.
Mm-hmm.
So people would think they're doing the right thing and it would lead to bad.
Yeah. And we're so isolated in our world. And I think, like, if God is real and he has this grandmaster plan to manipulate the people, like, he would know and would be the best person to manipulate the people and would concoct this thing, right? Like, that's unstoppable. Like, that's the whole thing. It has to be unstoppable. So it can't look evil. Like, the second coming of Christ, the Antichrist is supposed to look like a Christ figure. People are supposed to be like, that's it. He's the cool one. And yeah, even knowing that the Antichrist is supposed to exist, like, why would he tell you that if that would give you an upper hand to notice? You're not going to know.
Yeah.
You're not going to know. That's not how it's supposed to work. again, not real.
I'm really going to know.
Big stories, fun stories. but yeah, nobody's going to know. someone who eventually we will cover it, because Left Behind was a nightmare for me as a child. I couldn't sleep for like 2 years from the nightmares I had from watching Left Behind. And I was a child that I didn't do anything wrong. I wouldn't have been left behind, but I was like, that's it. Revelations is coming. Yeah. And I'm going to be left here all alone. so I have an intimate knowledge of what the end of the world is like, because it scared me so much. So you want to know your enemy, you know? So I want to talk about a spiritual awakening. So where the Conjuring series, which we tore apart, highly recommend you listen to that episode. The Conjuring series' approach to Catholicism is uncultured, unnecessary, and manipulative. Midnight Mass is a story told from a true fan, someone who understands religion and its beauty and horror. Right? I've said before that I find Flanagan to be a huge fanboy of whatever it is that he's working on, right? He so greatly loves, appreciates, and understands the founding media. He is influenced by it in his shows, and it comes through beautifully because of that. In The Haunting of Hill House, something so much his own resonates with the love and appreciation for Shirley Jackson, haunted houses, and the horror genre. Bly Manor, too, is a love letter to grief and horror and in life. And in this show, I can see his dedication, appreciation, and honest critique of religion, right? Midnight Mass is a story about spirituality. It's about hope and perseverance. Flanagan shares the impact of his upbringing in the church and shares how it can be healing and helpful. And as a fan, he comes from a place of care, right? Cautioning against the misuse of religion, how easily it can be turned into a weapon in the wrong hands when fanaticized, when it is no longer about a higher being, a question about a place, our place in the world, and what it means to be a good person, and instead revolves around people and placing them in positions of power, which is one of the big reasons why I stopped being religious. I was like, I'm not praying to no man. No, ew. no, thank you. Regular guy, who's that? That's why we weren't Catholic. I didn't want to talk to a priest.
It's fair.
But his passion for blending horror with reality elevates his work every time. And as the New York Times noted in a recent profile, Flanagan has earned a reputation for what might be called humanistic horror. While never skimping on the nightmare fuel, he believes that horror can offer something deeper, which they all can, but he does a very good job of it. So in one of the other incredibly impactful conversations, again, of which there are many, Bev is confronted in the end by Riley's mother, Annie. Finally, Bev is told what we've all been thinking. She says, "You are not a good person." I was like, she could have stopped there. It is just desserts, and it feels good to see her sinister smile falter. But the line that stayed with me most is when Annie Flynn accepts her son in all his sin, right? She acknowledges that, yes, he was an addict, and he took someone's life, but that makes him no less her son. And even more importantly, it does not make God love him any less. And she says, "God loves him just as much as he loves you, Bev. Why does that upset you so much?" And I was like, oh, shit. It's like, oh my God, you just ruined this whole lady's career. Like, it's such a line. And it's so true.
Yeah, it's with the burn.
It's because it, because to me, Bev represents like American religion, which is like, it's not real. It's a cloak they put on, and it's a weapon. And I feel like that's the question we need to be asking people who are like trying to use their religion as a way to control other people and condemn them and say, like, you're going to hell. Like, you don't have that power, first of all. if you're religious, you're just a person of the congregation, you know, you don't have that power. And you should know that God loves everybody all the same. Yeah. Like, that's the whole, anyway. And it's in this moment that
why does that make you so mad?
Why are you so mad that you're equal to us? Something that could be so beautiful for everybody else.
So it's almost like racism infects things. Yeah.
Racism, all kinds of isms. It's in this moment that we confront the real villain, not taking any of the onus off of Monsignor, who's people temples this whole town. Jim Jones is.
Yeah.
It's pretty awful. It was a little triggering, to be honest. The true villain, I think, is the bastardization of religion, the corruption of it, and the making of it into a weapon. So for me, Bev was the biggest villain of all, because unlike Monsignor, who believed he was helping others, Bev was always trying to control them and to be above them. She represented this flimsy American Christian ideal that infects and corrupts our government. In an article on the University of Chicago Divinity School titled "Midnight Mass and the Specter of Terror," writer Sahar Gumkor shares, "It is likely that many people will view this series as one that warns of the fanaticism inherent to religion, against which secular prophets have long sounded the alarm. But Midnight Mass presents something far more interesting. The social rot in the island community had sunk in before the revitalization of the church made it a prey for fundamentalists. One cannot watch the show without reflecting on our current times, the contagion of Trumpism, the resurgence of ethno-nationalism, and proliferating conspiracies. We are being warned of the threats of human depravity, the breakdown of community, a looming insularity, and how these dangers can stir the monster within us, a monster that can don the mask of piety." And then in a review on Vox by Romano, who we've actually quoted before, titled "Why I Felt Betrayed by Netflix Midnight Mass," they share the eerie reality that a character like Bev mirrors, saying, "Bev's complete readiness to usher in the Book of Revelations might sound over the top, but it really isn't. As I watched Midnight Mass," madness, "I was frequently reminded of Mississippi, oh my God. I was frequently reminded of Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who recently defended his leadership of the state with the worst pandemic death toll in the U.S. by claiming that people who believe in the afterlife don't have to be scared of those things." Insane. A real person said that with power. Anyway, also, Ajay Romano, totally valid. The critiques in that article is that I get it. I get the anger.
Yeah,
I'm coming from a different place. So Midnight Mass ultimately is a story of redemption, rebirth, and acceptance of our place in the world. What happens when we release ourselves from the heavy burden of mattering, of having a place in the world, right? Instead, we become the cosmos dreaming of itself, released from obligation to ourselves. Myself. That's the whole problem with the whole thing. That word, self. That's not the word that's not right, shares Aaron in her final moments. Kat's going to explain more, but she says, the electrons of my body mingle and dance with the electrons of the ground below me and the air I'm no longer breathing. And I remember there's no point where any of that ends and I begin. I remember I am energy, not memory, not self. My name, my personality, my choices all came after me. And yep. Close this out in a personal essay on Bloody Disgusting. Flanagan shares his belief in the supernatural, saying, I don't believe in miracles in the way they're described in the Bible, but I do believe in miracles in a different way. The miracles in our lives, some we make, some simply happen to us. The miracles of parenthood, of creation, of growth, and of forgiveness. This show is a miracle. I do believe that. It's a tiny, fragile bubble, and it clung on for years and years, finally coming into existence quietly, delicately, in between moments of seismic continental shifts in our world. Religion, I believe, is one of the ways we attempt to answer the two great questions that ache within us all. How shall we live, and what happens when we die? And I don't know the answer to the second question, although my thoughts, wishes, and even my best guess are articulated in this show. But Midnight Mass has, over the years, helped me at least begin to answer that first question. And so, as Aaron lies dying, she spends moments reuniting with the universe. Monsignor Pruitt reconciles with the life he was denied. Sheriff Hassan and his son, Ali, pray in the face of a rising sun. And Bev contends with the meaninglessness of her existence, a life wasted on wanting and needing superiority. And the town of Crockett, saying to the heavens, forgiving each other and themselves for the horror they wrought, accepting their human faults and releasing those sins to a higher being, and return to the cosmos to dream another day.
Yeah. Stinking beautiful.
Yeah, that's what Flanagan is.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know what kind of spiritual I am, but I was raised absent of religion entirely. Like, I don't know any of the things. No one taught me. I went to church a few times and they were negative experiences, and then I was like, all right, that's all I need to know. And that's because I got the version that you're that Bev is. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
That'll turn you off.
A community, very like neurotypical, everyone's talking about each other behind their back, like, gross. Yeah. Didn't like it. Would not go again. But I've had positive experiences in some religious settings where it's like the people do care about each other and it's nice. But ultimately, I think I'm just like more spiritual. I believe we go back to the earth, all that stuff. So I was like, this is the thing. This is the thing that I think. So that's crazy. And I didn't have like any of the context for it. So there were so many like clues or like hints, like, hey, this is something's happening here. And I was like, I don't know. I've never read the Bible. So I'm just like, that means something, I'm sure. It's warning me about what is to come. And I had no context, but I thought it was beautiful ultimately. Yeah.
Also, anything Bev says, because when she weaponizes parts of the Bible and she says stuff, and I'm like, that's not what you, girl, you can't be saying stuff like that. You're so twisted. I was like, that's not what that means.
Yeah. And it's just, I've met Bev, you know, mm-hmm, I've met her too. Before. Like, there's like people who manipulate words in order to get the outcome that they want, in order to get selfishness. And it's like, if you think about, like, as you said, like American religion, it's specifically, it's very self-oriented. Like, there's, that's the whole thing. That's mm-hmm. imperial, that's manifest destiny, imperial, like, us, that's versus what them. It is. It's gross. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, there's like, it's inherently going to have this like skewed concept of self that actively goes against the teachings that are written out. So it's very contradictory ultimately, but I thought the critiques he gave were like really nice, and yeah, I just thought it was neat. But what I'm going to talk about in my section is that we're all going to die, and I am in no way arguing with that senator did. Like, I think we shouldn't have to die so soon. That is the issue. Yeah. We should get a long life, and it's not an equal thing.
Yeah.
Because of oppression, you know, like, they're like, death is the great equalizer. It's not, because we make systems that kill people sooner than other people, and then it's not equal, actually.
It's such a crazy thing to say. Because, like, what if you're, it's like a murderer. Like, oh, well, they should have been so afraid of dying. Are you kidding? What are you doing?
Yeah. And it's the hypocrisy, ultimately. It's like saying one thing about one group of people and then saying the same, like, not recognizing the same exact thing for another group of people. It's just super hypocritical. Mm-hmm. And that's what our government is, ultimately. But that's a different discussion. Today, we're talking about death. And its inevitability and the unfairness surrounding it as a systemic issue. But death is something that's loomed over humanity and much of philosophical and religious thought for much of human existence. It's something everyone's been thinking about. Once you find out about death, your life inevitably changes forever. I've traumatized a preschooler by accident when I used to teach, and I helped them discover death happened. And it was very upsetting for both of us because I didn't want to do that. Because I told them about presidents. They're like, where are they now? And I'm like,
not here.
And then we realized we shouldn't talk about presidents to like four-year-olds yet. That's what I learned.
Kids be asking stuff. Where are they now?
Yeah, and I wasn't ready. I didn't do like a peer group to establish that that was appropriate for that age group. I didn't anticipate that question. And
that's so funny.
I am stupidly honest, and it's a problem. So where we are, our morality and our mortality and its inevitability and inescapability can either be interpreted as life's greatest horror or the most beautiful thing that we end up doing. Everyone does. Eventually, we all do. And Midnight Mass and much of Flanagan's work centers around this. Death, belief, legacy, and what it all means to us as people. So he likes to play with these concepts and how they intersect with things like that are more concrete in like addiction, mental health, grief, familial trauma, capitalism, religion, otherism. Like he really does like poke at the way society uses all of these beliefs and how some of it's like complicated and it's not fair in ways. So in Midnight Mass, these themes are just as present with special focus on how these themes intersect with religious fanaticism and belief in its purest form. The big question we see grappled with over and over is, if humans believe in heaven and an afterlife, why do humans cling so heavily to consciousness? If death is inevitable and inescapable, the same question applies. Why spend time fearing and fighting something that we cannot prevent as a natural part of the life cycle? The reason, ultimately, is because there's inequity that exists and makes people die sooner, and that's fine. But we see many religious ideas explored in the show in a deeply emotional way surrounding death. And Flanagan proposes something interesting, which is that all the things, honestly, all the quotes you gave, Gabe, were lots of moments for me. I was like, that changed something in my mind forever. Yeah. And it was just like really impactful. Like there was just, in all of Flanagan's work, like there's just something so beautiful about how everything is said. And there's no wasted air, you know, there's intentional silences. And anytime it's not silence, like people are saying things so beautifully.
Like I didn't even mention
like all the monologues
when, I forget her name right now, Lisa, and how she confronts the man who shot her. And he's like, she's like, you reached through time and you stole from me. Like you stole my future. The things I could have been, could have done. And that, I'm telling you, there's like no end to lines. Like, this is it. And I get it. Cause he was literally like, this was my journal. Like anytime he had a thought, a profound thought of any kind of human existence, he would like, when you write it out, someone's going to say it in the show.
He made acting portfolios for these people. Like really? Everyone has like a performance moment and they all deliver every single one. So I'm not going to quote the same part of Aaron's speech, the monologue, but there's pieces I took out the part that Gabe already said, and I'll say the other pieces. So Aaron says, as she's dying, the body stops a cell at a time, but the brain keeps firing those neurons, little lightning bolts like fireworks inside. And I thought I'd despair or feel afraid, but I don't feel any of that. None of it, because I'm too busy. I'm too busy in this moment remembering. Of course, I remember that every atom in my body was forged in a star. This matter, this body is mostly just empty space after all. And solid matter, it's just energy vibrating very slowly. And there's no me. There never was. I was bef- I was before them and I'll be after, and everything else is pictures picked up along the way. Bleeding little dreamlets printed on the tissue of my dying brain, and I am the lightning that jumps between. I am the energy firing the neurons, and I'm returning. Just by remembering, I'm returning home. And it's like a drop of water falling back into an ocean of which it's always been a part. All things, a part. All of us, a part. You, me, and my little girl, and my mother and my father. Everyone who's ever been, every plant, every animal, every atom, every star, every galaxy, all of it. More galaxies in the universe than grains of sand on the beach. And that's what we're talking about when we say God. This one. The cosmos and its infinite dreams. We are all the cosmos dreaming of itself. It's simply a dream that I think is my life every time. But I'll forget this. I always do. I always forget my dreams. But now, in the split second, in the moment I remember, the instant I remember, I comprehend everything at once. There is no time. There is no death. Life is a dream. It's a wish made again and again and again and again and again and on into eternity. And I am all of it. I am everything. I am all. I am that I am. And I'm just like, yeah, you know, I don't know what I believe, but I do believe that we return to the earth. We are energy. Like if we intersect science and religion together, that's what this is. Like, you know, it's both things are true. It's just, we have a different how. We have a different understanding of the conceptualization of what reality is. Like, it's just a different answer, but it's still the same answer. Mm-hmm. Like, if home is return, like if heaven is just being with all the people you love, you returning your energy to the pool of energy with all the people you love, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
That's the same heaven.
It's all perspective. It's how you interpret it. Yeah. It's just like that whole thing with Riley, and he talks about the stars and how they're little campfires in the sky. I was like, it's perspective.
And it's like all the religions have similarities for a reason. We're all just interpreting the world in some way, in our existence in it, and our concepts of death and where we go afterwards and what energy is and what life is. And in this version, we respect life.
Mm.
We love life. We love the planet. We love every living thing because we are a part of every living thing. How beautiful is that? Okay. I'm sorry. I just really love, like, I was just like, that is dope. Ultimately. So in unpacking that speech, we see that Flanagan is not trying to give us the answer, but an answer for what comes next. And if heaven, as we said, is all those things, it's just, it intersects everything really beautifully. So to have almost everyone in all their different view, there was something that was like sad about it though, too. Specifically when I first watched it, I was super conflicted that we see everyone sad. Like the ending is rough. Mm-hmm. Every single favorite character you had goes almost. There's two people who survived the entire thing.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
But they all do.
It happened.
Right? I mean, everybody does die. They just did it at the same time.
Yeah. And at first I was like, dang, I really wanted them to get out, you know? Like there was like a part of me like hoping for a happier or like a kinder reality, and I'm like, no, but that is the world. And I think to have almost everyone and all their differing viewpoints and all their different feelings and emotions all return, as you said, together, everyone did, realizing all the desperation and clinging to life they spent the whole show doing, that death, that ending was inevitable, was powerful. I still feel, as the idealist inside of me, I didn't want that to be the ending. I wanted a kinder ending, but I recognize reality currently.
I love it. A true Shakespearean tragedy where they all die. I love it.
See, no, I just like, don't do it. stay here forever. Mostly because I'm the one still here and I'm like, dang, I gotta miss you.
Yeah, that's real.
It's more that. If we all get to go together, cool, I'm gonna go too. But like, if I get to be left here and then like everyone I love and I have nothing left, I'm just like, I might as well have drank the blood and become a vampire. Why did we even try to escape on this tiny boat?
It's like the rapture. You're getting left behind.
Yeah. I don't want to be left behind.
Now you understand my fear.
If someone read me books as a kid, I would have also probably had these nightmares for like months at a time. Like my existential dread would have activated way sooner. Or at least for like more context. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that you had to experience that.
Don't show it to Byron.
No, don't do it. See, I like The Matrix.
That's your own existential.
That traumatized me.
Yeah.
But that was different. It wasn't everyone I love is going up to heaven and I get to stay here. That sounds awful. But neither here nor there. If death is our great equalizer, it's important to recognize the intersectionality of that. That if our mortality is sped up by socioeconomic factors perpetuated by a society and various oppressive forces, it's not a great equalizer. So while I do agree that everything and everyone dies, it would be false to call the exodus from consciousness a truly equal or equitable process. Sometimes we aren't given or afforded the things we need to be here, or are taken from us. Like, we're not given healthcare, we're not given resources, housing. These things are not rights in specifically America. Mm-hmm. And we're not given the tools we need to survive, many of us, and disproportionately, if you're not a cishet white man in the government, like, you're going to be having a hard time. We aren't given the tools that we need to have a fair shot. So death is not an equalizer because we're not reaching that point on equal footing. So my theory for why we cling to this version of consciousness is twofold. I think it, like, when you mentioned that he liked Buddhism, I was like, I felt that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that in there. Because first, we get attached to this version of consciousness, not because of, like, I think our personality, our concept of self, it's because of who we know, the people we love, and like all of our connections. So if like existence is suffering under Buddhism, I actually read stuff from that at least, so I know a little bit about that. If existence is suffering and the key to enlightenment is to detach ourselves from the things we're attached to, you know, like, then we'll experience enlightenment, not suffering. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we're clinging to this version of existence, we're getting attached to the people and the things around us that are tangible. You know, they're certain, they're visibly right there, and it's all encompassing because that's our reality. That's what we see and that's what we know. So it's easy to like understand. And then second, it's because in a capitalistic world filled with an abundance of suffering, we get attached to what we know, you know, like there's nothing we have theories about what happens next, but we don't know. It's not mm-hmm. something we can physically hold in our hands. So it's very hard to be certain of it versus like the people around us that we love and care about. So I think it has nothing to do with ourselves unless you're of the subset of humans that are Bev. And it's mostly like the people who you just won't meet in the same way ever again. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, the more we crave connection and attachment and inherent human behavior, the more we fear death, because even if we are us when we leave, we won't be the exact same us again.
Mm-hmm.
The personality, the memories, the images that we get played in those last moments as we fade into the everything, we won't get that same picture again. You might go at a different time than the people you love, so you'll be introduced back into the soup at different points. It'll be harder to find each other again.
Mm.
So I think that's why we cling to life, because we have a specific set of existing things around us, people that we love, that we might not get to see again in the same way. We won't get to be connected with in the same way. So we're craving that connection. And there are people, that we'll leave behind, and that how we exit deeply impacts them. As someone who has been deeply impacted by the exodus of other humans, it is something same. That is life-changing, life-altering. You will never be the same again. And the way everyone in the show left those two kids on the boat by themselves, I'm just like, there is such a kinder way that we could have left our future.
Mm.
And if we are everything, shouldn't we be working and looking towards that future so that we don't leave the only two people left in our lives stranded on a boat with no resources or where to go? They're in a little tiny boat. It doesn't even have a motor. They're 30 miles from land. What are they going to do?
Well, they're not everything yet, right? They're still just themselves, which is a very isolated, like, singular view. So it's hard to think. It's hard to think about everybody else. They didn't even know that they survived. They just kind of hoped that they did. They all said, I'm choosing to believe that they did.
Yeah. And where I'm at is, as humans, I want us to do more than that. I want us to think about I don't want us to try to live forever. I want us to create a world that lives forever.
Yeah.
And then we help that so that there's not oceans and fire and everything's awful. And then the things that we hope made it to the boat, I don't have anywhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
So we don't leave
there. We want there to be somewhere to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my next section is what we leave behind. So ultimately, we are not taught enough about death at all. And what we leave behind when that intersects with like all the systemic things at play, but specifically capitalism. So as someone who has recently had to help close an estate, I say, if you have time, dear God, research it. Make a will. If you don't even think you need one, make one. Write a list. Put it in a drawer. They'll count it.
Mm.
Just say it's a will. Do it. Leave letters and words for your loved ones. Even if it's you're crying and it's hard, because we could all go at any time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's my advice. Make a will and leave words and comfort and solace to the people you love, because we don't all enter the soup at the same time. And they're going to still be here not knowing their everything, wondering what the heck is going on and being sad as hell. And you could make that easier for them. So please do that. That's my what we leave behind. We should want better for those that we love, and even if only temporarily, so that they can enjoy the time that they have on this earth. Because if we're all fleeting memories, let them have good ones and find closure in our exodus. To use the ending of the show as an example, it would be a kinder ending, as I already said. I kind of like ad-libbed and then wrote stuff down. If the only two survivors of this atrocity seen in the show had more than an old rowboat to show for all the trauma that they experienced, like, so if you're leaving people behind, it'd be kinder to leave them behind with more than just a ton of trauma, no economic resources, and without the things they need to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, on a personal note, the main thing I would fear of death is not the pain of it, it's not the people, like, I want to know I'm going when I'm going so I can say what I need to say. So that's another thing that we talked about in the, what is it called? The movie where they're in the winter and there's wolves on the plane, The Gray. And he tells him that that's what's happening to him as it's happening. Mm-hmm. So he can like find peace in those final moments. The worst thing you can do is to lie to me. Ugh, I would be like so dumb. Because the illusion of more time. And then ultimately, that's just what life is the illusion of more time. So ultimately, the show seemed to leave us with an understanding that peace comes from living in the now and being kind to each other and not trying to cling to another day, just doing good while you have time to do good and leaving things for the people you love, so that when you go into the soup, they have something to do and something to hold on to you with until they get to the soup, because it's a long time in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So let it be good. So that's kind of my two cents there. And just as like how in the final moments, everyone of Crockett, like other than Bev, kind of like came to terms with that. People just joined together into taking like a moment of kindness. They're singing to each other. They're, as Gabe said, like having that moment on the bridge, like everyone is like, okay, it's inevitable. We accept it and it's fine. And let's just have these moments together while we have them. That's what life should be. Mm-hmm. And if you cling to life like Bev and death, you're creating a cycle of desperation and destructiveness where you're not going to be kind to the people around you because you're just thinking of yourself. In clinging to life, we as humans are willing to do awful things and hurt each other and not acknowledge that that's what we're doing, all which is pointless when we think of how inevitable it all is. And my last little piece is about Bev, because I just have a special place in my heart of disliking her. You know what I mean? Like,
She's the real villain.
I don't understand her, and she makes me mad. So there's something interesting about the mental state of each person that we see at the close of the show. But most interesting to me, because it's just so, I just can't fathom it in the way.
Incomprehensible.
Was Bev. Yeah, I'm just like, and I start, and the more I thought about it, the more I like really started to come to grips with it, is that if Bev believes what Bev believes, accepting that there's an afterlife, the inevitability of it, Bev didn't fear death. She feared accountability above all things. She knew that Annie, Riley's mother, was right about her, that the sheriff was right about her, that everyone that said the honesty to her for the first time ever was right about her. She was not a good or kind person while she was on this earth. And in looking at the theory surrounding the afterlife, if there is a heaven, in that, in her understanding of what the afterlife was, there is a hell. And Bev's fear was leaving this world because she wasn't going to the good place. You know what I mean? So that made sense to me. That's why she was trying. She was like, this is the only
version of life
that I have. Yeah. Like, she knew she wasn't going anywhere good. If she goes to the soup, she's going to be a worm next time. You know, like, she's not having a good, but she's going to be punk of everything. I don't know. She's going to the wrong part of everything.
God loves her just as much as everybody else.
Yep. So while the bulk of the town faced death and the consequences of their actions and forgave each other because they had otherwise lived kind and caring lives, Bev ran from that reality because she knew if there was a heaven in the way that she understood it, she would not go there. Death is scarier when you know you have lived a life of harm and cruelty without consequence, because consequences come for you eventually. Or that's the idea. That's what guilt and shame as humans motive us, made us to think, is that eventually, we haven't gotten our punishment. We are going to get it eventually. And all this clinging to life is just running from that inevitable future. That's another theory. but so with that character in mind, our fear of death could align with our guilt and shame surrounding the actions we took in life. And that if consequences, as I said, did not come, they will come. And that's just my two cents. I'm not a religious person. But that...
You can be a spiritual person.
I'm a spiritual person. And don't be like Bev. Bev sucks.
Don't be a Bev.
So mean. She's poisoning dogs.
Yeah. In a world of Bevs, be an Annie, right? Riley's parents, like, just like Riley, who's definitely their child, they didn't hurt anybody. They were like, no, I'm going to die. I'm going to die instead.
Yeah. And that's a choice. Like, it's not this just because everyone's doing it. You can make the choice to not do the awful thing in the face of so much awful. They were good. I'm sorry.
No.
I didn't realize I like the show so much.
Right? I'll tell you, the first time I watched it, I was like, this is good. I really liked the ending. And I left feeling like, wow, that was really good. But the second watch, literacy glasses on, it hit me different. And it's going to be hard for me to choose which one of these is good.
Because we do our ratings. Great. Yeah.
They do so many things. And he does them well. It's so hard to do that. And this one especially, like, especially knowing, like, how much of himself he put into it, because with the other ones he's like adapting and he's fanboying over, you know, literature and the horror genre, and then also just like intertwining that with human experience. But this is like so much himself, and it's so vulnerable and so real. And it's something that I think I get people being upset because it doesn't condemn religion, and religion can be harmful. But I think that's just the thing, is like, it absolutely can be harmful, but it also can be something beautiful that people need. It's a tool. It's a tool. Who uses it?
Yeah.
So.
And how they use it. Yeah. Exactly.
So next week we'll talk about The Fall of the House of Usher, and we'll try to do those ratings and what our emotions are. Tell us what you thought of Midnight Mass. If you're religious, what do you think happens when we die? Is there heaven or hell? Do we return to the cosmos? We're nothing but stardust, right? Tell us about it.
Return to death.
Yeah. Mike Flanagan, if you're watching this, give us a shout out. Let us know if you listen. And if
that would be
we
neat.
Were on the mark, right? We were on the money. And don't get married.
They'll eat your kids, literally.
Yeah, they might eat your kids, but then they come back and then they die anyway. Or your kids end up on a boat.
We're all in the pool, you know?
The goop. We're all going to be back to the goop.
We'll all get there eventually.
All right. Bye.
Bye.